Okay, we are in the meeting room downstairs in the Concord Free Public Library. I'm Carrie Klein here with Michael Klein. And would you introduce yourself? Say my name is?
Yes.
And I'll be glad to hold that.
Oh, great. Thank you. My name is Sherry Foreman Litwack.
Okay, and date of birth for some perspective?
September 11th, 1951.
Okay. And tell us about your people and where you were raised.
Well, I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, and in the 50s, in the 60s, and it really was a kind of an idyllic time to grow up, to be living in Newton. For one thing, they had great schools, and it was, you know, the days when in the summertime you could just stay out after dinner outside and play ball in the street until someone's mother called them home and until it got dark. And, you know, it just was a very kind of freeing, creative place for kids to grow up, and it was wonderful. After that, let's see, I went to college and graduate school in the Boston area. I went to Brandeis undergraduate and the Harvard School of Ed. And then after that, I got married to someone I met in college. His name is Steve Litwack. And he was finishing graduate school in Syracuse. So I got a teaching job in that area. And we lived there for 2 years while he finished his program. And at the end of that time, we decided we both wanted to come back to the Boston area. I actually ended up getting a job in publishing. I thought I'd be continuing in teaching, but I had the opportunity to get into publishing. And I did that and stayed with that my whole career.
Publishing?
Yes. Well, let's see. The publishing was more educational publishing. I worked both in-house and independently in the field of reading and language arts in particular, and also children's literature. That brought us back to the Boston area. My husband, his first job was as a school psychologist at the Hamilton Wenham High School. So,
I'm sorry, Hamilton?
Wenham High School.
Spelled?
Wenham. W-E-N-H-A-M.
Thanks.
And that's in Hamilton, Massachusetts, on the North Shore. And we actually lived in two homes there, house-sitting, and one in Wenham and one in Beverly Farms, and it was really such a beautiful place to live, also kind of horse country. And but then after we were there for 3 years, we decided it was time to look for a house, you know, to buy a house, purchase a house. And we looked on the North Shore in that area. We loved that area. But then we both changed jobs, and I started working, because at that time I was working in Boston for a publisher. Then I started working for a publisher in Lexington, and my husband got a job in the Brookline school system. So we were both commuting, and we said, maybe we should also start looking for houses someplace closer to where we're working. So we started to look in Concord and Lexington as well. But we fell in love with Concord. And for so many reasons. For one thing, it reminded us of the North Shore in many ways. There were aspects of the community that were similar. And for me, the literary history, the architectural preservation of the town, and the sense of community were just a great combination. And so we were fortunate enough to find a house in Concord. First, it seemed like, we couldn't afford anything in Concord. This was in 1979. But we were kind of determined to keep trying. And fortunately, we finally were able to find a house on Monument Street. And it was actually quite charming. When we first moved in, our newspaper was delivered by a young boy on a pony. we used to refer to it as the Pony Express. I know, it was really pretty neat. And
what year was this?
This was 1979. And I actually never get tired of driving the 3 miles down Monument Street because we live 3 miles from the Colonial Inn, so we're quite a ways down there. But it's so beautiful in all seasons. And we love how the landscape transforms from suburban to rural when you sort of start in the town of Concord and then you keep going further and further out and it gets quite rural. And, of course, highlights along the way. Old North Bridge and the Old Manse, the view of Hutchins Farm and Water's Edge Farm, which is out near where we are. So for us, it's like you see the town's revolutionary, literary, and agricultural history, all the things that really make Concord special along the way. So
I'm not familiar with those farms you mentioned.
Well, then you have to take a ride out down there. The Hutchins Farm that's about a mile and a half from Concord Center, and it's an organic farm. It was, and I'll be actually mentioning the Bemises, but it was owned by the Hutchins family, Mr. Hutchins, well, it became it was the mother whose last name was Hutchins, and she married a Bemis, and I'll talk a little bit more about that family. But the vista is just one of the most beautiful scenes. I mean, people stop their cars just to see it, whether they're on bike or on, you know, in a car. People paint it all the time. It's just a beautiful agricultural scene. But they also grow wonderful organic vegetables. So, and the Water's Edge Farm is a horse farm, and that's out. That's almost the 3 miles to where a few houses beyond that. So, again, they're beautiful vista of just horses grazing. And it's interesting because my parents, whenever they would visit and they would drive by that farm, they'd always say that you couldn't find a prettier rural view even in the English countryside. And it does have that feel about it. So you must drive down that far. Just keep going about 3 miles. And I also want to talk a little bit when I think about Monument Street and just talk about some of our neighbors, because we have had some wonderful neighbors, and in particular the Woodmans, who are really a multi-generational family in Concord, lived here for probably at least three generations. But Mr. Woodman, who has since passed away, but his wife Ethel still lives across the street from us, but he really defined what it meant to be a good neighbor. He was the type of person that would get up at the crack of dawn in the winter to plow our driveway during a snowstorm so that my husband could get to work on time. Yeah, this would be like 6 o'clock in the morning. We would hear Mr. Woodman. He'd be on his, you know, one of those sort of, like the rider type of mowers, but with a plow. And he'd you know, just come over and plow the driveway. And another thing that we always remember that he did was when we wanted to put an addition on our house, he made sure that he went to the hearing so that he could speak on our behalf. And we didn't know he was going to be there, but there he was just to say what good people we were and why we should be able to do this project. And of course, everybody respected him. So he really was quite a special person.
Do you remember his first name?
Yes. So this is kind of fun. So his first name was Byron. And Byron is a family name. His name was Byron. His son's name is Byron, and Byron is actually a lawyer in town and is a wonderful person and businessman in town, but people called the son Byron Woody as he was growing up, but then that Byron had a son and named Byron, and of course as he was growing up he was called Woody. So now, even though when we first moved here we would refer to our neighbor's son as Woody, now we call him Byron and we call his son Woody. So it's really a fun family name. Another nice connection actually to the Woodman family is when our daughter, who's now 35, she was born 2 years after we moved to Concord. The Woodmans across the street, Ethel and Byron, their granddaughter, Hunter, babysat, was our daughter's first babysitter, and we had her babysit when Carolyn was just 6 months old. We look back on this, was just 6 months old, and Hunter was 10 years old. And so we say, how could we have let a 10-year-old babysit for a six-month-old? But the truth of the matter is that besides the fact that Hunter was very mature for her age and loved children, we really had the whole extended family that were babysitting, the grandparents across the street, and then her parents behind them. So it was really a nice situation. And Hunter now has three children of her own. And the other, the Woody I was talking about, that's her brother now, you know, her brother Woody. But she has three children of her own. And for many years now, because her eldest is at least in high school, but they would always at Halloween go to visit her grandmother across the street to show their costumes. And she would always make a point of coming to our house, too, so that we could see their costumes. And I have many pictures through the years of them growing up. And, yeah, so it, you can see very special family in so many ways. Thinking about other neighbors and what makes them special, there's Mary Lawrence, who, and I don't know if she's done an oral history, but if she hasn't, she would be a wonderful person to do it. She's well into her 90s now, and her husband, Raymond, his family owned much of the land on Monument Street near where we are. And she, when I take my walks, if I'm lucky enough and I see her sitting outside, she loves to, and by the way, she still mows her lawn, you know, hand mower, and does you know, a lot of the gardening and so on. A remarkable woman. But if I'm lucky enough and she's sitting outside while I'm taking my walk, you know, I stop by and we have a chat. And I love to hear her talk about the stories of Concord when she was first married. I know she's English, so she was born in England. But she, you know, came when she was living in Concord as a young bride. And so she tells wonderful stories about there was a cabin in the back. There's like a small pond and a cabin where they'd have these wonderful parties all summer. And you can just kind of imagine what that was like. And another neighbor across from her, I think it was the McLaughlin family that I know was connected to Houghton Mifflin. Winston Churchill visited that home, and I think believe that Mary had a chance to meet him, and you know loves to share those stories. So it's fun to think of our neighborhood before we were there. Another great thing about Mary is she has a great sense of humor. So she is an arch Republican, and so when there's an election, she gets the biggest sign she can for her candidate. And I remember one of George Bush, probably both George Bushes over the years. But the fun thing about it is her neighbor across the street for many years was Corey Atkins, who is a Democratic Massachusetts congresswoman. And Corey's driveway is right across from Mary's house. So Mary would get the biggest sign she possibly could and make sure she planted it right, you know, where Corey would see it every morning. But of course, they were also great friends. And when I think about that, you know, you wish that the political parties today, you know, that people could still, you know, get along like that as people, even if they have some differing opinions in terms of their political views. But we always got such a great great kick out of those signs. Another neighbor, and I actually mentioned them when I mentioned Hutchins Farm. I hope this is okay talking
this
about the neighbors.
Fabulous.
This is okay.
Yeah.
It's definitely a sense of the community for me. Mm-hmm. When our daughter was 6 months old, about 6 months old or so, when she was a baby, somebody said, "Oh, there's another baby about the same age in the house in the woods behind you." And actually, literally, it was like this path that led into the woods behind. So I said, "Oh, that's good to know." So I put Carolyn in the in the stroller, and we walked down this, you know, kind of dirt path to this house. I know it sounds a little bit like a fairy tale, but that's exactly what it was like. And knocked on the door, and Jane Bemis opened the door. And I, you know, I mentioned, I said, somebody said that you, you know, you might have a baby about the same age, and I just wanted to meet you. We're neighbors. She invited me in, and her daughter is Liza Bemis, and so I always say that Liza was my daughter's first friend, and they're friends to this day. Liza was also a bridesmaid at my daughter's wedding 4 years ago. So, you know, that's really obviously a special, special relationship. And then I thought I would, so that hopefully gives you a little bit of a sense of our kind of the neighborhood and how it's changed. And of course, when we moved to the neighborhood in 1979, we were the new, you know, like kind of the new family. And now, where we feel like now we're the, you know, we're the elders in many ways too. But as it should be, you know, as neighborhoods change. But then I thought I would talk a little bit about how I started to get involved with the community and the library and all of that. So I guess I started getting involved with the community as when my daughter was young, when she was growing up, and the first volunteer experience I remember was at her preschool, which was the Barn Nursery School. It still exists. And it was a parent cooperative. So that meant the parents would help out. And we loved her teacher, Frances Weber. And we actually ended up following Frances to the Neshoba Brook School, where she ended up teaching kindergarten, and then she ended up teaching first grade. So my daughter had her for like 2 years in nursery school, kindergarten, and first grade. So it takes a very special teacher to, you know, to want to have a teacher for that many years. But the special way that I like to help out at the school through the, like the Parents Association, was running the book fairs, which...
Crinkling. Anyway, back to the book.
Yes. So I would run the book fairs, and as you can see, there was a theme with my publishing experience, and we were. Besides it being a wonderful book fair where people could buy books, one of the things I wanted to do was bring children's authors and illustrators to the school to do presentations. And because I had some connections to publishers, I was able to do that. And we brought people like Tommy DePaola and Mark Brown, who's known for the Arthur series, and Natalie Babbitt, Lois Lowry, Jane Langton, Barbara Cooney, who these are just some of the, if, for people who know children's literature, really some of the best writers and illustrators. So that was a very special experience. And then the next probably major volunteer experience I had was on the board of the Friends of the Library. And I was actually the president from 1990 to 2001. Which sounds like an awfully long time, you know, to be president. But I loved it, and it was something that I wanted to continue to be involved in. And when I was president, we actually initiated some programs that are still going today, such as the Music from the Library series, Friday Flicks at Fowler, which is a film series, and the Miller Award for Excellence in American History. And so, anyway, I'm just thrilled and delighted that those programs are still going strong today.
And the music, is that indoor or outdoor both?
Well, we actually have both. This particular series, the Music from the Library series, is indoors, and it's held in the rotunda of the main library, which, interestingly, has excellent acoustics. And that wouldn't necessarily be the case, but... The person that we found, and the reason that it became so successful, is that we found another Concordian named Sally Sanford. She's married to Sandy Smith, who is a trustee of the library. now as a trustee of the library. But Sally is a very talented singer herself and really an expert in music. So somehow we connected with her, asked if she would be interested in trying to start a series like this, and she took it on and is just doing it to this day with a music committee. And the quality of the programs has been incredible. We've been fortunate to get people like Russell Sherman, who might be wanting to try out a new program, so he'll do it here. And we've had many emerging artists who then have gone on to have, you know, very, very nice, very good careers. But it's interesting because, you know, all our programs are free and open to the public, as are the music programs. But with the music series, it's been so successful that you have to reserve because we run out of space. There's no charge, but you have to reserve, and you can't do it any earlier than 2 weeks, I believe it is, before the concert. So when that, and we advertise it on the website, you know, and we let people know, you know, when it is, within 10 minutes. It's full. It's like, people know you. I must put it on their calendar. Call at this time. And it's a nice problem to have, but that when we have even more space at the library, which I'll talk a little bit about too, hopefully we'll be able to have even more people, experience these concerts. So those are indoors. They usually are about 3 to 4 a year. Then outdoors, there actually also are summer concerts, and Karen Ahern, the children's librarian, I think she may be the one who started it a number of years ago, but those are more like family concerts where people picnic on the lawn, and some people do like almost like a Tanglewood, you know, like sort of fancy picnic, but most people just, you know, just have a much more casual approach to it. But it's many different, like, more like folk music, and a lot of different ethnic groups come, you know, Latin music, and just really all many different styles of music. And so I think they're usually about 3 of those in the summer, and those are really a lot of fun.
Just outside the front door?
Just outside the front door on the lawn. Yep. Yep.
Not a huge space. I bet that's crowded too.
It is. I mean, you'd be surprised how many people you can get there, but it's also most of the lawn is covered, which is really delightful. Which then reminds me of the Friends Library book sale, because that's also held on the lawn. The Friends of the Library have been having the book sale as their major fundraiser for many years. Definitely before I was involved on the board of the Friends of the Library. And it is, as I said, it's the major fundraiser. And now I'm not on the board of the Friends, I'm on the Library Corporation board, but I still volunteer for the library book sale because I people have often heard me say it's one of my favorite days of the year. It's like just the best community event. It's just, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to go, but if not, if you like books, I'd strongly recommend it.
Can you describe it?
Yes, I'd be happy to. What makes it so successful? Well, lots of things make it so successful, but one of the main things is that we have book sorters. They're all volunteers and have had for many years. And, you know, some people are book sorters for many, many years, and then new people come on. But all year round, people from the community donate books. And because of the town we live in, the quality of the books is, and then the number of books is really great. You'll get hardcover books that, you know, look brand new, basically, and they're sold for $2, and, you know, so people know, including dealers, know that the Concord, you know, book sale is really something special. And so the book sorters, as books are donated, they sort the books into categories, and they have refined it over the years, more and more categories, but everything they've done has made a difference. When I was president of the Friends, I believe, because it still was our major fundraiser, I think we raised in the vicinity of 8,000 to 10,000, and we were thrilled. I mean, we thought that is just terrific. Now it's closer to 18,000 to 20,000 in this one day book sale. I mean, it's unbelievable. So the sorters are amazing. One of the sorters is Janet Kamenstein. She started getting involved, I don't know, at least 5 years ago, maybe longer, but she has retail experience. So what she's brought to it, well, she's brought many things to it, but just the way things are displayed and things that really make a difference in terms of people buying more or being able to see the books better, whatever it is. And so it's wonderful to see volunteers like that, you know, be able to make such a difference. And so, as I said, it's one of my favorite days of the year. We usually try to have some music. There's someone named Tom Ruggles who lives in town, and he'd be a good person for the oral history, too, if he hasn't done it already.
Are you Gigi Ilias? Ruggles?
Ruggles, yes. Yes, R-U-G-G-L-E-S, exactly. And his wife, her name is Jano, and she has been a book sorter for many years.
Jano.
J-A-N-O-T. And Tom, one of the things that he does for fun is he has a band / barbershop quartet. I don't know, I'm not sure exactly how I would describe it, but really fun music. And so for many years, those musicians have volunteered and they'll play. So that adds just a really nice atmosphere to the whole event. And it's just very festive and a lot of fun.
Just tables and tables and tables.
Tables and tables and tables. But as I say, very well organized in terms of subjects, you know, so people, you know, some people go right to the cookbooks and you know, they know what they're looking for. We always have a specials. We call them special section. And those are books that are special for that we might not want to sell for just, say, $2 or, in the case of a paperback, $1. But that we want to charge a little bit more for because of its nature. Sometimes they're related to the history of Concord or, you know, various things can make them special. That's a separate section, and some people come especially for that aspect. But just over the years, the volunteers that we've had, I think of, Claiborne Dawes, who's been a volunteer for many, many years as one of the sorters, and, you know, she just people, just what people bring to the experience is really incredible, and it's really special.
You hope it doesn't rain.
Yes, so, right, so we always have a rain date, which is the following Saturday. There have been times, when I was president of the Friends, it's the president's job to make the call if there's a question of whether it's going to rain or not. And there are times when that's a very hard, you know, decision to make because it could go either way. And as you can imagine, even if it doesn't start off raining, if it starts later on, that's, you know, your merchandise is ruined. And so, yes. So there are times that we've gone to the rain date, and there was at least one, if maybe a couple of times, where we had to go to yet another date. But one year was really interesting because what happened is we had the sale, and it's busiest. It opens at 10. And people wait. You know, crowds gather. We have like a rope that goes around the periphery. Crowds gather, and then we drop the rope, and people come running in. it's really something to see. We always say we have to take an aerial photograph of it. It's really an amazing sight. So this one year, it was probably about maybe 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. So, you know, the rush piece was over, but there's still quite a few people, and it's open till 3 o'clock. It started to rain, so we had tarps, and so people went rushing to, you know, put the tarps over the books and try to preserve the books. Well, most people who were shopping didn't leave. And we have pictures of people like lifting up the tarps and, you know, picking out their books. And that's like the dedicated, I don't, you know, it's really amazing to see that love of books, a love of something. But, but we thought, okay, so this year we're not going to do as well as, you know, we usually do, but, you know, we can't help. That's the one thing we can't control is the weather. We ended up breaking a record that year. None of us can still believe, like, how could that possibly have happened? It happened. So, you know, it's really, there are lots of fun stories, you know, to tell about the book sale. So that represents my experience with the Friends in particular, and I do continue that through my volunteering for to work on the book sale. One other thing I do want to say about the book sale is that there's been a really fun tradition where we sell refreshments, so we always try to get kids of either people on the Friends board, or usually it's children of people on the Friends board, to sell the refreshments, because, you know, to try to get the kids involved. It's almost like having a lemonade stand and that kind of thing. But one of the most wonderful stories was that a number of years ago, a mother came by, and we were setting up for the book sale, which, by the way, we start setting up at 6 in the morning, and the book sale actually opens at 10. But, you know, and we get it's all volunteers, you know, that come and set up the table, you know, just set everything up. And we've had to come up with a real process, as you can imagine, for getting, because now I don't remember the number of books, but if you heard the number, you wouldn't do it. I want to say 20,000. It's probably more than that. I mean, it's an incredible number of books, but they all have to be brought up to the lawn and put in the right place and so on. So one year we're setting up, and a mother came with two young boys, and she said, "Can you use their help?" And the expressions on their faces didn't look like they particularly were interested in helping, but clearly the mother wanted them to, you know, learned what it was like to volunteer, or just give them something to do or something. So we never turn away a volunteer, obviously. So, you know, I gave them some things to do to help with the setup. But then they ended up staying after the book sale opened. So I said, okay, we need you to sell refreshments. So they liked that idea because it was kind of like their own thing to do. And I'd say at the time they were probably maybe middle school age at the most, maybe even younger than that. So the next year, they just showed up. It was, you know, and so we said, oh, great, great. So, of course, yep, you're in charge of the refreshments. They showed up the next year. Now they're in high school, I have a picture of them through the years. So, of course, you know, just because of the way boys, you know, develop and grow, they look like little boys when they came, and they look like men, you know, when they left. They actually came back year after year until they were seniors in high school. And they actually, I think, did come the next year just to, like, visit and say hi. But, you know, for these two young boys who were not happy about, you know, what it was, one of their mothers, you know, who kind of got them into this thing, it turned out to be something that I think became really a special thing for them, and certainly a special thing for us. So I could go on and on about the book sale, but it gives you an idea.
All great.
Good, good.
Really inspiring.
Good. So let's see, after being involved with the Friends of the library, I was invited to join the board of the Louisa May Alcott Memorial Association, which is the board that runs Orchard House, the home of the Alcotts in Concord. And that was something that was special to me. As I had mentioned, one of the reasons I moved to Concord is that, you know, the literary connections for me were very special. And I still have my childhood copy of Little Women, as I know thousands of other women do, and probably some men too. So it really, you know, felt like a privilege to actually be on the board. And during my 10 years, we had some very interesting times. We purchased the house next door, which allowed us to preserve the historic house more because we could move some of the administrative offices to that house. Because have you ever been in Orchard House? Have you ever been? It's on Lexington Road. But it's a very old house for one thing, and the weight bearing, the offices were on the second floor, and the copy machines and equipment, and it was really doing a job on the historic house, and so it enabled us to move all that over to this other house, and also some of the programming that obviously they like to do a lot of the programs at Orchard House itself, but anything that involved maybe children doing craft projects or something messy like that, again, we could have it, in another location. And the caretakers of the house were able to live there as well. So it really did help us to preserve the historic house by purchasing the house next door. Another project we did, and this one is, I don't quite even understand how we were able to accomplish this, but the house had to be, the basement had to be reinforced. And the way, and other work done in the basement, in order to do that, they had to actually lift the house, the whole historic house. Which, again, for an old house, that's pretty precarious to begin with. But the amazing piece is that the house museum never closed during this whole process. It's the house, it's an historic house that people come to visit, so here there is actually a picture that you can see if you're at Orchard House that shows the historic house on this kind of metal crane or lift, and again, the fact that they remained open, well, the director, Jan Turnquist, is an amazing woman. The fact that they were able to remain open during this whole process is quite incredible. But anyway, the work was done, and it was successful, and so it was great. And another highlight when I actually became the president of that board for a few years, is that the First Lady, Laura Bush, came to visit. And one of the reasons she came is that Little Women was one of her favorite books growing up. And as you may know from some of the work she did, not only when her husband was president, but afterwards, that literacy is very important to her as a cause. So this was just something that she wanted to do. And I don't think she had ever, in fact, I'm sure she had never been there. So it was interesting. There were certain protocols that you had to follow, as you would imagine. And we were instructed not to put our hand out, to wait till she... And this wasn't her... These weren't her directives. This is obviously the security, for the White House that had these rules. And they said, no, don't extend your hand to her. Wait till she extends it to you and things like that. But she herself couldn't have been nicer. She was very warm, it really was a pleasure to have that opportunity and to meet her.
It was when she was
First Lady, yeah, which made it obviously extra special because of that. But also for her, it Orchard House and Louisa May Alcott and Little Women had a special connection to her because of her mother. She remembered reading the book with her mother, and she grew up in Midland, Texas. And, and that's where you see, what makes Concord so special. Orchard House and many other places in Concord are really pilgrimages for people. Walden Pond, the library, special collections, and just so many places in town. So I'm sure some people here take it for granted. I know there are people in Concord who have never been to Orchard House, and I'm always amazed by that. But then when you hear about people coming from, and not just all over the United States, but all over the world to visit these places, it gives you, a renewed appreciation. So I enjoyed my tenure at the Louisa May Alcott Memorial Association on that board. But after I had done that for a few years, I was invited to become a trustee of the Library Corporation. And that, for me, that was really a very special honor because it means that you're a steward of the library. And
steward?
A steward. And this is what I mean by that. The library was founded in 1873 by a man named William Monroe. He lived in town, and he donated the land and a building to be used for the purpose of a public library. But the way he set it up was as a public-private partnership. And what that meant was that the Library Corporation, which he created, would be a nonprofit organization, would own the buildings, the grounds, and the special collections, which I think he referred to as special holdings at the time. And we sometimes speculate, why did he set it up that way? And we can only guess that perhaps that was his way of protecting, the assets in a sense, because if a town is running short on money, they might say, oh, let's sell this painting or something like that. We don't know, but that is how it was set up. And I think that has really ended up being very much of an asset to the town, because what that means is if the library needs to do a renovation, it is the responsibility of the Library Corporation to raise the money to do that. It's not the obligation of the town to pay for it through taxes. And so while, of course, the town would, support the project in various ways, and we need to work very, very closely with the town when we're doing these kinds of renovations or projects, because the town is responsible for the staff. You know, they hire the staff and pay for the staff, and so the Library Corporation can't just go about saying, "Oh, well, we're going to add on all this space or do whatever we might do," and the town just needs to pay for the staff, to support it. So that's not the way we work. The way we work is together. If we have a need, then we work with the town to figure out how we can make it happen together. Another thing that William Monroe did when he set up the library is artwork was always, from the very beginning, was a special part of the library, which I know is not true probably for most libraries. So it's almost more what I might say more like an Athenaeum in that sense. And so the artwork has really become part of what we now refer to as special collections. And that also, some of that is artwork, as you see on the walls here, but it also includes manuscripts and, special, like, town papers and a variety of things that are in our archives. But again, we think back on how wise he was to kind of set it up the way he did, and it really ended up being even a more special gift to the town because of that, I believe. The Library Corporation, I became a trustee in 2007, and I've served as president since 2011. And there have been some highlights so far, and I hope there will be more to come.
We'll have to hear about some.
Okay, great. One of them is that we renovated the Fowler Branch Library. Now, and that was probably about 5 years ago. And this was, this is a reflection of Concord as a community and what the community values. This was a time when it was more close to the recession, when we were starting to talk about it, especially, doing it. And people were saying this is not a good time to fundraise. But not only that, but many towns were closing their branches, branch libraries. They couldn't support them anymore. But our community, and the corporation was, you know, was responsible for raising the money, but that, how does that happen? It happens with support of, you know, people in the community who want to support the project. We were able to do this major renovation at that time. And one of the things that worked in our favor as far as the recession was concerned is prices that were better in terms of materials. And so that was a big selling point that we said, if we do it now, it's going to cost us a lot less than if we, you know, wait a few years and try to do it. So a lot of people who had the means to support us thought that you know, they'd be getting a much better value for their money, you know, if we were able to do it at that time.
And that was under the guise of the corporation, not the Friends. Right?
Yes.
Can you distinguish those two?
Yes, that's a really good question. Okay, so there are basically three groups related to the library. One is the Friends of the Library, which I talked about to begin with, who sponsored the book sale. And the Friends, also a nonprofit group, I think the Friends started in the 70s. I think that's when that group began, in the 1970s, I believe. But what the Friends do is the money they raise goes primarily for programs. They sponsor a lot of the children's programs and adult programs. It goes for things like museum passes and large print books and CDs and a variety of materials. And they get their money mainly through the book sales. There's also a book sale in around the holiday time as well. And also they have membership. As well, so that's where their money comes from, and they use that money to sponsor the programs and some of those services I mentioned. Okay, the Library Corporation has a very different, and that's where the word steward sort of comes in again too, because the Library Corporation owns the buildings, the grounds, and the special collections. We are responsible for preserving and maintaining the buildings and the grounds and the special collections, so if we ever want to renovate or expand, it is the Library Corporation that is responsible for raising the money to do that. So hiring the architect and, you know, the contractors and all of that piece. So. And then the third group is the library committee, and that is more of the a town committee, just like there would be the school committee, and there are various town committees. So the library committee is the town library kind of connection, and they're responsible mainly for long range planning, policies, things like that. The three groups together really are more than the sum of its parts, because, again, the community just benefits from the combination. And we all have very specific missions, very different missions, but we work together very closely. Obviously, any project that we did for, a building project clearly would benefit the programs, which the Friends, you know, plan. So they, you know, then we can have more programs because of, you know, some building project that we might have. And actually, a really good example, I'll just finish talking a little bit about the Fowler project, and then I'll mention another big project that we have coming up. So the Fowler project, what happened, this was a interesting example of how this happened. In the 1990s... Yes.
Spelled Fowler.
Fowler. F-O-W-L-E-R. Named after Loring Fowler, who lived in Concord.
This was not the main branch.
Right. This is it's in West Concord. It's the branch library, and it's in West Concord. Mm-hmm. And so that building originally was built, I believe, in like the 1930s. And then there was a renovation in the 1990s. But at the time, the Library Corporation could only wanted to take on, you know, a certain size project, raise so much money. So they were able to actually create a much bigger and better... They added on a little bit to the building, but also were able to really have a much better children's room, and they were able to make other improvements. But one of the other things they did is they put in an elevator shaft. And what that meant was that in the future, if another library corporation board, you know, wanted to take on the project and take it to the next step or the next phase, the whole bottom level could be developed and essentially double the space of the library. And because the basement was being used for storage and a few things, but it really could be developed as very usable space.
It's one on one level now, they're just the first floor?
As of the 1990s, it was just still on one level. It was built on one level. And there was a basement, but as I said, it was more of a basement and not particularly usable space. So in the 90s, they did a lot with the first floor. They put in this elevator shaft, should in the future, you know, just as a way of maybe hoping that in the future more could be done. So our board, the project I think was finished about 5 years ago, but when we started planning it, maybe closer to something like 8 years ago, decided that the time had come. That, you know, first of all, West Concord was growing, and more and more people were using the library, using both libraries, and so we said, this is the time. And so we decided to take it on as a project, and we were able to complete it. And that's when I got back to the fact that it was good timing because of costing less money, because materials were less at that time. And we were able to finish the bottom floor, and now that's really a very beautiful space, and there's a huge meeting room that many community groups will use for meetings and other workspaces. But that's a nice example of one board being able to take the project so far, making some great improvements, and then setting it up so that a future board, which was how many years later? Let's see, 95, 2005. Probably at least 15 years later, maybe even more, that happened. We appreciated their foresight, and then we took advantage of it.
It's so Concord to think ahead and go the extra stretch.
I think that's really true. So the next big thing was about 3 years ago, almost exactly. The house next door to the main library was for sale, and that's 151 Main Street. So when that came to our attention, the board discussed whether we wanted to consider, again, it would be the Library Corporation Board that would be responsible for buying it, not the town. And so we said, this is something we should seriously consider because we're landlocked, and so if we do have some ideas of ways we might want to expand, that's probably the only way we're going to be able to do it. And so we did decide to buy it. We were able to do that mainly because we had received a wonderful bequest from someone that really, that significantly increased our endowment. And again, the power that a gift can make, this is like a perfect example of that, because I'm sure that without that gift, we would have said, no, you know, it's a great idea, but we how can we afford to do it? I mean, and especially to have to raise the money after the fact, and, you know, it's just, it would have been too frightening and scary, and you know, I don't know that we would have been able to make that leap.
So bequest,
responsibly.
At the time of death, is that a bequest?
Yes. And I hope I'm using the right term, but it was at the time of death. And it's actually a wonderful story about this particular woman who did it, because her name is Helen Codere, and C-O-D-E-R-E. She volunteered at the library for many years. And she became, she and the director really became friends over the years. And when she passed away, she left a considerable sum to the library. And, she, wasn't, married, did not have children. She did leave some of her money to other family members. but a very substantial amount she left to the library. And what that gift is, you know, first of all, it was able to help us with Fowler as well because of the timing of it, but really it enabled us to buy this property next door, which is going to have a tremendous impact to the future of the library. So you just never know, when these opportunities are going to come and how wonderful they are. But the tricky part about the buying of the house was that it was around Memorial Day weekend. That's how I know that it was almost exactly 3 years ago. And as a result of that, many of the board members weren't around. I mean, it was a holiday weekend, they weren't around. But if we wanted to put in a bid, we had to put it in Monday was a holiday, by Tuesday at noon. And because there was already interest from other people in the house. So through a series of phone calls, conference calls, we felt that we had to do certain things, do our due diligence before making that decision, because, it was a significant purchase. And so we first of all want to establish the need, even though, that we didn't have a lot of time to do that. So we worked with our library director, Carrie Cronin, to talk about, if we had more space, how might it be used? I mean, we knew that our programs, like I mentioned, the music series and other programs, were oversubscribed, in terms of people wanting to attend these programs. And we also knew that libraries are changing in certain ways, and we wanted to be able to adapt and evolve, with changing times. So Carrie was able to speak to the staff and come up with things that if we were able to, what we could do with additional space. It was at that time that I think I never appreciated more than ever how wonderful our board is. You always hope that a board will have the skills that you need to do what they need to do, make decisions. But it's at a time like this when you have the right people, because we had the financial people who were able to run the numbers and, let us know whether we were going to be okay as far as that was concerned. We had people with legal expertise who were able to help with the drawing up of the contract and getting that signed in a timely manner, ask the right questions legally. We had people with building expertise and contracting expertise who were able to meet with the zoning people and the building commissioner in town to make sure that it was going to be something that would be okay, for the library to do. And we had someone who had town governance experience, so she knew the right questions that we needed to ask, again, to make sure that we were doing this, that this was something that was going to work as part of the public-private partnership. And it just, all the pieces, came together. And so by the end of the series of conference calls, we made the decision that we wanted to move forward, but we felt that it was essential to talk to the town manager before we actually made the move. And because Monday was a holiday, we had to have our bid in by noon on Tuesday, Carrie Cronin, the director, she had a meeting scheduled already with the town manager on Tuesday morning. And she said, I'll get in touch with him and see if you can meet with him during that time that I was planning to meet with him, and she would join us. So she did that. He said yes. So a couple of the trustees and Carrie sat down, told him about this opportunity. He thought it was a wonderful one. Apparently that house had come up for sale quite a few years before, and he had thought at the time, wouldn't it be nice if, although the library wouldn't, I'm sure, have been able to do it at that time. So he was very supportive of the whole idea. And while we were meeting with him, the town manager, the person on our board who has this building experience was meeting with the zoning person and the building commissioner, asking those questions. Then we got together. We said, okay, looks like it's a go. So we had another trustee at the lawyer's office ready to draw up the purchase and sales. And he did that. And I went to the office. We signed what we needed to sign, got those papers. and we got it. And so it really, it was just such a great example of, you know, having to work together in a really short period of time to accomplish something that was really important. And
congratulations.
So, well, thank you. So this house is an historic house, and it's a really very unique house inside. But we have now, we have architectural plans of how we could integrate the two buildings. We went through a series of, we did a lot of market research to make sure that we knew how libraries are evolving and what our needs might be for the future. And that included doing, we did surveys, we brought many groups into the house. We did focus groups. We really did all the things we thought we should do to make sure that we had a good plan for how we would use this additional space. Now we're at a point where we're on to the next phase, which is the Library Corporation. As I mentioned, we're responsible for being able to raise the money to make this happen, and so we're at beginning stages to do that, and we've hired a feasibility consultant who's met with quite a few people. Where we're feeling confident at this time that it is something that people will support, but we have a lot of work to do to make it happen. So that's one of our big initiatives in coming years. But what it will do is we'll always preserve what makes our library very special and unique. And as you know, we have some beautiful historic spaces and wonderful spaces to reflect and write and all of that. And at the same time, we see libraries changing. Some people would say that libraries are going away, but research shows otherwise, and our own personal research definitely shows otherwise. Our library is busier than it's ever been. Circulation is up. So it's interesting because it's busier, yes, because people want programming, and we've got lots of wonderful programming, and that makes sense that libraries are the future. But that's what a lot of people are going to want to come to the library to learn and be exposed to different things and so on. But we're also hearing, while our technology will continually to be updated, and that'll be a very important part of the new plan. At the same time, we're hearing from parents, don't get rid of all the books, because they feel that their children are so plugged in so much of the time that they want to still have experiences with print books, you know, whether it's a child sitting on a lap and reading a book, or just it's a different kind of reading experience. And we believe we live in a town that can support both, you know, that we can have the updated technology and we can still have, you know, the printed books, and we can still have our special collections, which, you know, are even, special manuscripts and all of that. So we were fortunate enough to have someone named John Palfrey come and
John
speak.
Who is that?
Palfrey,
Palfrey.
Frey. He's actually the head of Philip Sandover Academy, but he wrote a book called Bibliotech, and I think it's something about how libraries are changing in the digital age, I believe is the rest of the title, something like that.
Once again, on the title.
Bibliotech, T-E-C-H, like as in technology, and how libraries are changing in the digital age. So he's actually kind of known as the expert now on how libraries are changing and evolving. And, whenever there's a program about that topic, he's usually quoted and so on. So we were fortunate to invite him to the library and speak. And ahead of time, we shared our plans with him. And we were very impressed that he actually read them, because during his talk he referred to them. He even said we had the program in our rotunda, which is that very historic space, part of the original 1873 building. He even said when I introduced myself, he said, "Is this the part that's part of the 1873 building?" I thought, for him to have taken the time to actually, read and absorb so much was really quite special. But the more important thing was that he reinforced everything we're planning to do, including, he said, including preserving some of the special spaces that we have, because people still want some of those kinds of spaces too. Not everything should be social, and not everything, I mean, you do need spaces for collaboration and things like that. Maybe some more hands-on types of experiences. But at the same time, there are still people, want to have the quiet spaces and the reflective spaces, and we're fortunate to have those as part of our historic building. So anyway, that's kind of where we're going with the library, and it will be interesting as time goes on, as we listen to these tapes. If people look back, I hope at that time, this will be a reality, and it will have a very positive impact on the community. That's what I'm hoping. And there's no reason to expect that it won't, based, I guess, on our history and the way this community really supports and cares about the library, cares about literacy, in general. My husband and I, because we moved to Concord in 1979, I guess we've been here about 37 years, we sometimes think about where will we go next, might we do in future years, but we're not ready to leave Concord. All the things that brought us to Concord, to begin with, are still so important to us. Its history, culture, the landscape, the sense of community. We just feel so lucky to live here. So those are some of the things that I wanted to share.
What a testimony.
Sounds like you've devoted every free moment to the library.
Well, it may seem like that. I mean, I'm glad my passion comes through, because it's really something I feel very deeply. I mean, that being said, I do... I have worked, professionally all along.
You have?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm fortunate in that the work that I do, that I still do, and that I have done, I've had some flexibility in how I've done it, although that's partly choices that I've made along the way. As I mentioned, I'm in the publishing field, and I... have worked in-house and have had some responsible jobs. I was the director of product development for a publisher for a few years, and I've had some, in-house jobs that were required a lot of responsibility. But much of my career, I've been an independent consultant, and I've done projects with different publishers. And what that's enabled me to do is, first of all, have flexibility while my daughter was growing up, so that I could volunteer at her school and do some things that were important to me in that regard. And also that I've been able to take on some of these other volunteer responsibilities for places that I really care about and love. So I feel fortunate to be able to have done both. But there are some weeks, you look because Carrie, the director, will sometimes ask us on the board if we can estimate the number of hours, because when you fill out, I think...
contribution.
Right, exactly. And you need that for grants and different things like that. When we actually do start to think about the number of hours, sometimes even we're surprised. And it's not certainly not just me. I mean, I would say everybody on our board. We're a very hands-on board. And the people that are on the board, because they're very well-respected people in the town, they could be prima donnas in a way, but they're They're not in any way, shape, or form. I mean, they are just people that, you know, each and every person on that board contributes in a very significant way. And so I like to call it the dream board, you know, sometimes.
The dream board.
Yeah, because we are so fortunate with that. And
is it a very large board?
No, not particularly. It's 9 people. And again, with our bylaws that were started in 1873, it was established as a 9-person board, and we maintain that to this day. It seems to work. But you do need dedicated people, and you do need people that really, you know, want to really take on responsibility and.
And you run the meetings as president?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That must be something that's its own set of skills to run a meeting effectively.
I think that's true. And it's interesting because I always am trying to continue to learn and do a better and better job in the sense of anybody on the board could be the president as far as, you know, their capability is concerned. And I'm sure they've been presidents of other boards, you know, over time. And many of them serve on other boards, and including boards for Boston institutions and so on. And so sometimes there's one person I'm thinking in particular he's been on many Boston boards. You know, he's given me some wonderful pointers. And these were actually because sometimes he said that the boards that he's on have had workshops, you know, on leadership and that kind of thing. And he'll share those materials with me. And so, you know, I try to apply some of what he's shown me and shared with me. This is the most difficult part, I'd say. Is knowing how long to let a discussion keep going, and when to cut it off, or to say, "Well, we need to talk about this in more depth, so we'll follow up and do that at another time," because everything everything or most of what people are saying is worth hearing. And we are making some important decisions and discussing lots of, you know, important things that make a difference. And so you don't want to really cut off the discussion. But in order to end the meeting in a timely manner and to keep things moving, give everybody an opportunity to speak, you know, you really do need to keep it moving and know when it's time to move along. And but I'm always learning and hope that I'm doing a good job, but that I continue to do, maybe I can do a better and better job.
Because you're expecting to be there for, say, an hour?
Well, I'd say on average, our meetings start at 7:30 and they end up usually at 9 when the library's closing. Not that we actually can close the library, but we generally like to try to finish by then. So they're usually an hour and a half. But that being said, we have many committees, and so people are, you know, then can do more in-depth work through the committees, really, and that's what often happens. But, yeah.
Complicated and worthy pursuit.
Thank you. It's definitely worthwhile. It's definitely worthwhile.
Hats off to you.
Well, thank you. But I really... I just really can't take any credit without recognizing the other trustees. I have the vice president is Mario Favorito, and he's the one with the legal experience. And I always say that he's the one that enables us to sleep at night. Because, as you can imagine, the fact that we actually own the buildings and the grounds and the special collections, it's a big responsibility. And so... he is, you know, really makes sure that we, you know, everything is
is done properly, whether it's related to insurance or security or just a number of things that we need to consider. Or any time we're doing any kind of an agreement, you know, we never do anything without running it by him. Then we have Rick Briggs. Rick Briggs is the treasurer and has been for a number of years. And he obviously is very good financially, but, you know, he really, you know, keeps us paying attention to our budget and, again, serves us very well, you know, in terms of being able to be run in a very professional way. And then there's... I never know who to mention next because each person is so important. Fred Lovejoy. Fred has lived in town. He actually was born in Concord, lived in town for many, many years, and went to the Fenn School. And he's the person I mentioned who's on a lot of Boston boards. He is a physician at Boston Children's Hospital. And now I'm not sure if he's at... I think he may be... may not be a meritorious position, but he, at this point, you know, he's there. Well, one of the very important things he did recently is he wrote the history of Boston, of Children's Hospital in Boston. And so, because for him, it's very important to document the history of organizations, and because everything builds on what everyone else does. And as we've seen with the library, for sure. And so, you know, he likes to recognize and record that. But he's the clerk. And again, you know, he could, you know, that he's willing to take notes and has been taking notes for so many, way before I was president, because he's been on the board for many, many years, you know, just again shows his commitment and his passion for the library. And then there is... Jeff Adams, and Jeff Adams is a contractor in town and seems like he's involved with practically every building project in town, not quite, but he almost. And so the fact that we own the buildings, you know, his expertise is really invaluable, unbelievably and important to us, as well as this project that we're about to engage in. and then Diana Clymer.
Di as in D-I?
D-I, yes, yes.
Which C-L-Y-M-E-R? Stands for,
yes, okay. Yes. And Di has also been on the board for a number of years, but she adds so much in terms of her grace, her enthusiasm, her passion. Really, she's been the one from the beginning with this project that has, I mean, she's our cheerleader, and she just expresses it so well. She happens to also be in charge of the grounds committee, but really the way, you know, her vision for the future is really remarkable and keeps us going many times. And then Sally Schnitzer, who was the honored citizen this year in Concord. In fact, we've noted that a number of the honored citizens have been trustees of the library, which is, you know, kind of a nice, nice connection. And Sally was a board on the board of selectmen. I think it's called the select board now, but the board of selectmen for a number of years, and she was chair. So she of that board. So what she's been able to bring to us, besides just being so intelligent and articulate, is the best ways to work with the town and understanding how the town works, and that's obviously invaluable to what we do. And then let's see, I have to make sure that I've thought about everybody. So